Hello, friends, and welcome to What's Happening Gem State. I'm your host, Brian Allman. I hope you all had a great Thanksgiving with your family and friends. I have a bit of a shorter show for you today, as we're in that lull between the election and the session, and I don't want to just talk to hear myself talk. I value your time as well as mine. Much too great for that. But I do have a few interesting tidbits of news and some ideas I'd like to share with you today. Remember that you can find the entire What's Happening family over at idahospodcast.com, as well as on Telegram at t.me/whidaho. You can also find me on Telegram at t.me/BrianAllman. Before we begin, I would like to share our new sponsor. Maples for All Seasons is a boutique nursery located in Eagle, Idaho. They specialize in all sorts of maple trees, from large sugar and Acer rubrum maples to ornamental Japanese maples, cultivars of which are specific to the Treasure Valley area. With over 20 years of experience, Barry and Sue Hoffer are two of the top arborists in the area, specializing in the pruning and care of all maples, as well as other ornamental trees. This boutique nursery is by appointment only, so call Barry at 208-408-0025 today. You can see their maples, get answers about your own maples, or just talk about anything regarding maples. To learn more, visit www.maplesforallseasons.com. Thank you to Barry and Sue for sponsoring What's Happening Gem State. By the time you watch this video, Thanksgiving will have already become a distant memory. However, I would like to take a few moments to talk about the importance of Thanksgiving, both as a spirit of gratitude, but also as a celebration of the founding of our nation. Thanksgiving is a uniquely American holiday. Yes, I know that other countries celebrate it as well, but the idea of setting aside a single day to give thanks to God, not only for our material needs, but for our freedoms, really grew out of the experiences of our forefathers in the New World. The Jamestown Colony was established in Virginia in 1607, and the colonists there faced disease and starvation, but persevered. The Plymouth Colony, of course, was established in Massachusetts in 1620, and the survivors of the Mayflower faced the same hardships. Both groups, from whom the future leaders of the American independence movement would come, looked to God with gratitude for the freedom they found in the New World. By the 19th century, those that we consider our nation's founders, they themselves looked back to the Pilgrim Fathers as the true creators of America. Early Americans revered these men, honoring their sacrifices that enabled the creation of a new nation. In 1802, future President John Quincy Adams commemorated the landing of the Pilgrims at Plymouth with an oration extolling their virtues. He said, quote, "The founders of your race are not handed down to you, like the fathers of the Roman people, as the sucklings of a wolf. You are not descended from a nauseous compound of fanaticism and sensuality, whose only argument was the sword, and whose only paradise was a brothel. Their glory has not been wafted over oceans of blood to the remotest regions of the earth. They have not erected to themselves colossal statues upon pedestals of human bones to provoke and insult the tardy hand of heavenly retribution. But theirs was the better fortitude of patience and heroic martyrdom. Theirs was the gentle temper of Christian kindness, the rigorous observance of reciprocal justice, the unconquerable soul of conscious integrity." End quote. This devotion to the first men and women from England who built what would one day be the United States of America is diminished today. Indeed, we were so busy with COVID and the George Floyd riots 2 years ago that we almost entirely forgot the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims' Landing. The social justice movements of the 21st century have actively tried to bury the history of the Pilgrims in favor of what they call a more inclusive history. But rather than simply telling all sides, they, in true Marxist fashion, paint the Native American Indians as victims and the Pilgrims as oppressors. Author Christopher Caldwell called this out in 2020 in a great essay for the Claremont Review of Books. Quote, "At work is more than a failure to summon the Pilgrims to mind. There is an active project to exorcise them, in order that the country might find itself a past more congruent with its present-day political commitments. A year ago, the New York Times launched a 1619 project dedicated to the proposition that the original, the more consequential, and therefore the real founding of the country came with the arrival of a Portuguese slave ship in Jamestown the year before the pilgrims arrived. Over time, the intended result is reached. Authorities cannot teach the story of the pilgrims even if they would, because most of them no longer know it. The story of the settlement of North America has become a scandal. It is worth looking more closely at who the pilgrims were and what they did to understand why so many people have grown so uncomfortable telling their story. End quote. While I believe it is important to understand and appreciate the stories of other cultures, there is something shameful about being made to denounce or forget the stories and legends of our own ancestors. The story of the pilgrims is the founding story of America, and this was understood by all Americans until just the past few decades. We can celebrate our own ancestors without ignoring the histories of other cultures. What happened to the American Indians, I believe, was an historical tragedy, but it wasn't entirely the fault of the white Europeans. They did not know they were bringing diseases to which the natives had no immunity. As Caldwell explains in his essay, the pilgrims arrived in a land that seemed mostly empty, as if God himself had cleared it out for them. The wars, strife, forced marches, and reservations that would come to define the relationship between the European Americans and the natives were still in the far future. Even King Philip's War, a conflict between the Indians and the settlers that is mostly forgotten today, was still a generation away. The first Thanksgiving was a moment of harmony and understanding between two very different cultures, and I think all of us should be able to celebrate that. I was taught in school that Thanksgiving represented a moment of unity between the very different cultures of the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Indians. Today, children are taught that Thanksgiving was the onset of genocide, as the evil white Europeans plotted the extinction of the noble Native Americans. White school children are shamed for even thinking about celebrating Thanksgiving. How can we hope for any reconciliation today when we have a faction that's deliberately instigating strife between peoples? It's no surprise that the erasure of the pilgrims coincides with an erasure of gratitude in general in our country. As our nation becomes less Christian, our people forget the God from whom all blessings flow. Without a spirit of gratitude flowing from our leaders, the population also becomes entitled and resentful. It wasn't always so. President George Washington issued the first national proclamation of Thanksgiving Day on the fourth Thursday of November in 1789. Though he didn't mention the pilgrims by name, he clearly associated a day of Thanksgiving for the new nation with the famous Thanksgiving feast shared by the pilgrims with their Wampanoag neighbors. In 1863, with the Civil War raging and no end in sight, President Abraham Lincoln renewed Washington's call to set aside the fourth Thursday of November as a day to give thanks to God not only for food and health, but for the freedom that all Americans cherished. We still celebrate Thanksgiving today, and many people still set aside time to declare their thanks to Almighty God for the blessings He's given them. However, as a people, as a nation, Thanksgiving Day isn't about gratitude anymore. It's about gluttony. It's about consumerism. It's about football on TV. The idea of gratitude has become quaint and old-fashioned in our culture today, replaced by an idea of entitlement, a demand that those who have surrender what they have to those who have not. Major political movements are built on the basic vices of jealousy and envy today. As we look around the world at all the problems we face, I think it's important to cultivate a sense of gratitude. We are materially better off than our ancestors could ever have dreamed, even when you account for inflation. We live with comforts and conveniences that even the greatest kings of old never knew. We have the ability to communicate with friends and strangers alike at any distance, in an instant. And despite the problems with social media, it has allowed us to build communities that span the globe. We truly have a lot to be thankful for. Consider that the Pilgrim Fathers had endured disease and starvation that killed half their population, yet they still gave thanks to God for what they had. Abraham Lincoln issued his proclamation of Thanksgiving in the midst of a war that would eventually kill 600,000 American soldiers and countless more civilians who would die of disease and privation. We shouldn't complain about our own situation, but instead be thankful to God for what we have and the opportunities we have to come. As this year draws to a close, I invite you to cultivate gratitude for what you have, to trust in God for what you lack, and to honor our ancestors who came before us, the ones who created this nation that we are fighting for today. I hope that you had a lovely Thanksgiving Day, and I wish God's blessing on all of you in the season to come. My name is Brian Ullman, and this is What's Happening Gem State. Are you interested in sponsoring What's Happening Gem State? Contact me at brian.ullman@proton.me, and we can work out a deal. I would love to shout out your business on this platform. Welcome back to What's Happening Gem State. My name is Brian Ullman. Our next sponsor is Cassandra Hendry and her team at J&O Real Estate. At J&O Realty, Keller Williams Realty Boise, they understand that buying or selling a home is more than just a transaction. It really is a life-changing experience. Their philosophy is simple: clients come first. They pledge to be in constant communication with their clients, keeping them fully informed throughout the entire buying or selling process. They believe that if you're not left with an amazing experience, they haven't done their job. They don't measure success through achievements or awards, but through the satisfaction of their clients. With 10 years of experience, Cassandra Hendry is your Idaho Realty Girl. Contact her at 208-982-0013 or find her on the web at idahorealtygirl.com. I want to thank Cassandra and her team for sponsoring What's Happening Gem State. Are you on Twitter? I'm on Twitter. Follow me at GemStateBrian. I like Twitter, despite its obvious issues. Ever since I joined in 2008, it has been at the center of political and social conversation in America. It really is the new public square. Sometimes I wish I had lived in the 1700s, when new philosophies were flourishing in the salons of Paris, the coffee shops of London, or the taverns of the American colonies. But in a way, we have the same thing today on Twitter. It all depends on who's in your circle. I follow quite a few people, some of whom are anonymous, who are often expounding on interesting philosophical ideas. There is some genuine, high-level conversation going on there. I've learned more about the history of conservatism, the theories of Schmitt, Hegel, Nietzsche, Jaffa, and Machiavelli, and competing political strategies from discourse on Twitter than I ever did in school. The philosophical drivers of the American Revolution were thinkers like Thomas Paine, who spread his ideas via the printing press. Today, the genesis of many ideas on the right comes from anonymous accounts like Bronze Age Pervert, Zero HP Lovecraft, or Fisher King. There are quite a few interesting people operating under their own real names as well. Pedro Gonzalez, Jesse Kelly, Ned Ryan, many others. I've learned more about personal health from P.D. Mangan on Twitter than I ever did from health classes, textbooks, or mainstream publications. Then, of course, there are the people who make it all a lot of fun, like Michael Malice or Alex Stein. By the way, the great troll himself, Alex Stein, will be speaking at the Canyon County Lincoln Day Dinner on March 4th, 2023. So stay tuned for details. Now, not every American is on Twitter. In fact, it really is only a small minority who are taking part in the discourse there. But the people who set policy pay attention to Twitter, which is why it's so important for our politics. That's exactly why the left has sought to exercise such tight control over the narrative there. We do know that censor-happy left-wing activists have taken over positions of influence in Twitter, and they've used it to not only ban conservatives like Alex Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, and Laura Loomer, but also to tweak the algorithm to push down conservative ideas while amplifying progressive ones. They make it look like progressive ideas have a lot more support than they really do in the real world. We also know that the federal government has taken an active role in censorship on Twitter and the rest of big tech. Do you remember the Hunter Biden laptop story? Left-wing intelligence agents, with no evidence, they lied and said it was Russian disinformation, and Twitter dutifully complied by censoring the New York Post, which had broken the story. I was beginning to think that the good old days of Twitter, back in 2015 and 16, when the discourse and the memes flowed, were gone for good. But Elon Musk's purchase of the platform has me thinking that the good times might be here again. He reinstated President Donald Trump, as well as many other high-profile conservative voices. And as of this recording, he plans to offer a general amnesty to everyone else who is kicked off the platform. James Lindsay, the tireless crusader against Marxism and schools and society, who had been kicked off by the previous regime for correctly calling out groomers, has also returned to the platform. Now, I get the temptation to flee to friendlier platforms. I hear people all the time saying, get off Facebook, get off YouTube, get off Twitter. And you know, I do get it. Anything we post on those platforms is in danger of removal at any time. And any community or business we set up that relies on those platforms is in danger of destruction at any moment as well. Yet I think it's a risk worth taking, because those platforms are where the people are and where you can have the most influence. Twitter is also a great way to communicate with local political figures. Now, Governor Little never responds when I tweet at him, but I have enjoyed interacting with others, such as incoming Senators Tammy Nichols and Brian Lenny. Those two joined with IFF's Dustin Hurst recently for what's called a Twitter Space, an event where a host can speak and users can join, listen, or even speak themselves. If we want to change our culture, we must engage with it, and that means sharing our thoughts and ideas with the world rather than simply remaining confined in our own little bubbles. I think the alternative platforms are great, and I maintain accounts on most of them. However, they are all echo chambers of one form or another. Gab is the far right, Gitter is the MAGA establishment, and Truth Social is for Trump supporters. Like it or not, Twitter remains the one place where everyone who matters is. I am excited about Musk's takeover of Twitter. He clearly has a vision of what can be possible with free speech and open communication. Twitter is the new public square, and I am glad to have a very small voice in the great discourse. My name is Brian Ullman, and this is What's Happening Gem State. As a reminder, you can support me directly by subscribing to the Gem State Substack. As a free subscriber, you receive every post, about 3 per week, in your inbox. As a paid subscriber, you help me make the time to create content that I hope is informative and inspirational. I really appreciate everyone who subscribes, everyone who shares my work. It really means a lot to me. So go to gemstate.substack.com to subscribe today. Hello, and welcome back to What's Happening Gem State. I'm your host, Brian Ullman. Nearly 3 years after the outbreak of COVID-19, we are able to look back and evaluate the actions of our elected leaders and bureaucrats who made the decisions that are still affecting us today. In hindsight, we know that COVID is worse than a bad cold, but not nearly the bubonic plague or Spanish flu that so many people predicted. Looking back, we know that the vaccine is basically a placebo at best. And we know that the lockdowns didn't stop the spread of the virus, but instead destroyed so many small businesses that our country relies on, as well as countless families. Beyond the totalitarian urge, it makes one wonder exactly why our leaders followed each other over a cliff. This might sound odd, but I think they were following a script. I'm not going the conspiracy theory route here, but instead I think that many people in positions of power simply acted as they were expected. They acted as if they were in a movie rather than real life. You see, it really is astounding how much that happens at the highest levels that doesn't have any rational reason. Entire bureaucracies are built around the idea of avoiding accountability for any one person. Remember the old adage that nobody gets fired for buying IBM? Government employees don't get fired for doing what everyone else is already doing. So when everyone was recommending lockdowns, your local bureaucrat did as well. Back in January of 2020, I sat down to watch the 2011 Steven Soderbergh film Contagion. It has been really fascinating since then to watch the events that happened throughout the world through the lens of that movie. The basic plot is that a virus comes from a bat in China and starts spreading throughout the world. As people begin dropping dead in America, the government imposes a lockdown. While the heroic men and women of the CDC frantically work to isolate the virus and create a vaccine, snake oil salesmen peddle fake cures and call the government's response over the top and illegal. Of course, the snake oil salesman in question dies a horrific death, while the vaccine is released in time to save a remnant of humanity. There's a heartwarming moment at the end where Matt Damon's daughter's boyfriend shows his proof of vaccination so that he can see his girlfriend in person once more. It really is very sweet. What was absolutely mind-blowing to me was the realization that this is how the COVID-19 pandemic was supposed to play out. Now, I'm not saying that Steven Soderbergh is somehow a puppet master controlling the world. Rather, what happened is that they based this movie on public plans from the CDC itself about how a deadly pandemic would likely go. Even as late as 2019, just before COVID was officially discovered, the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins University collaborated with the World Economic Forum and the Gates Foundation to present Event 201, a simulation of a virus that rapidly spread throughout the world. The simulation involved researchers attempting to find a vaccine for a new variation of the SARS virus before it killed 65 million people. In the meantime, citizens were rioting in order to get their hands on various cures or treatments. It's clear that the powers of the earth had a plan in place ready to go for the next viral outbreak. Remember, these things happen fairly regularly. SARS-1, H1N1, bird flu, swine flu, Ebola. It's entirely possible that COVID-19 would have come and gone the same way as these past outbreaks. But this time, there was a plan in place to impose totalitarianism on the world. We saw videos from China of people dropping dead in the streets, videos that looked remarkably like Soderbergh's film. We learned that Tom Hanks contracted the virus while in Australia, and we all worried that it could strike any of us next. Professional sports leagues canceled their seasons. Schools and public buildings shut down. On March 25th of 2020, Governor Brad Little issued a stay-at-home order for Idaho. Here in the Treasure Valley, our Central District Health Board banned large gatherings and imposed a mask mandate. The rest is history. Very few people opposed the shutdowns for fear that they would be accused of callousness regarding public health. Jesse Kelly, on Twitter, was one of the few who stood his ground, saying that you can't simply stop the United States economy and then expect it to start back up again. History has obviously proved him right. Now, you can map the governmental response to COVID-19 along the same line as the plot to the movie Contagion. A new virus came along, so our government locked us down to give them time to craft a vaccine. And then once we proved that we've taken the vaccine, we can rejoin society. Yet reality sometimes has this stubborn tendency to ignore the plan. The lockdowns proved ineffective at stopping the spread of the virus. Masks were mostly ineffective as well. Some of the supposed snake oil, like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, turned out to have at least some efficacy. Following their script, they told us that the vaccine would protect us from COVID-19, but that turned out to be wrong. Then they told us that it would at least stop the spread. Lies. Then they told us that, well, it will lessen the severity and the risk of death. More lies. The Washington Post, of all places, reported last week that 60% of new COVID deaths were among the vaccinated. And finally, the central premise of the entire charade, that COVID-19 was on par with the deadliest outbreaks in human history, was also false. Most people who got the virus recovered just fine. The people most at risk are the elderly and those with comorbidities. You know, the same people who are at risk of long-term damage and death from the regular flu. Yet so many people persisted in their delusions, and so many persist to this day. There are still some who wear masks in their cars as they drive to the grocery store. Our leaders kept following the same script even as reality contradicted them at every turn. No matter what data came out about the efficacy, or lack thereof, of masks, lockdowns, or vaccines, they still said we had to follow their dictates or die. Joe Biden threatened us with a winter of disease and death if we didn't get the shot. I think a revealing part of the script that they were trying to follow was in how important public health officials were supposed to be. In the movie Contagion, the doctors at the CDC were the heroes of the story, risking their lives to track down the virus and develop a vaccine. Now look back to 2020. Do you remember the endless videos of nurses dancing on TikTok during the pandemic? Do you remember the way that the media outright worshipped Tony Fauci? Do you think this might have gone to their heads? Imagine for a moment you're Fauci. I know, it's an awful thing to do, but just for a moment. Imagine you're Fauci, a well-paid but little-known bureaucrat in the public health system. A pandemic begins. This is your time. Suddenly you are front and center, not only on the cover of magazines and newspapers, but people are hanging on your every word because you're the expert. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter if you contradict yourself from day to day. People will do what you say. Shut down businesses? Done. Close the schools? Right away, Dr. Expert. Triple mask? Why not? Would you be able to resist the urge to control the citizens? To treat them like so many toy soldiers? Fauci clearly couldn't, and neither could so many petty dictators in their little positions of power. Health and wellness guru P.D. Mangan had a great thread on Twitter recently where he said, quote, "Why did so many public intellectuals get COVID wrong? The lockdowns, the masks, the vax, the IFR? Because they had a self-interest in inflating their own importance during a time of perceived crisis, so they hyped the crisis aspect. And many of them are regime auxiliaries, connected to government, academia, and big business, so they wanted to be seen doing their part. Those who got COVID mostly right were thinkers and writers on the margins, and that's no coincidence. For example, Bitcoiners, carnivore dieters, climate skeptics, all seemed largely COVID skeptical. They were already accustomed to looking at the official stance on many topics in a skeptical way. Let's not forget the gym bros and a few well-known athletes, many of whom were prominent skeptics." End quote. Have we lost the ability to be skeptical of our leaders? They lied about Trump. They lied about Russia. They lied about what a healthy diet is. They lied about Iraq. They want a world with less of you, and while you're here, they want you fat, sick, and compliant. They lied about every facet of COVID-19. Why should we give them the benefit of the doubt ever again? The worst part, I think, is the lack of humility by these public figures. Biden never apologized for saying the vaccine would prevent you from getting COVID. Tony Fauci never apologized for promoting lockdowns and mandates. Randy Weingarten of the Teachers Union has never apologized for pressuring schools to stay closed. All these people never apologized. They just doubled down. And then they have the nerve to ask for a pandemic amnesty. Even Brad Little here in Idaho has never apologized for his stay-at-home order. In fact, he just denies that he ever locked us down in the first place, dissembling in a way that would make Bill Clinton blush. Unfortunately for those of us demanding accountability, it seems that the electorate simply wants to move on and forget that this ever happened. On Twitter, musician and personality Zuby pointed out that the architects of the lockdowns were mostly rewarded by voters. He wrote, quote, "It appears that virtually every mayor, governor, and premier who pushed full-blown C-19 tyranny got reelected. All around the world. You really can't save people from themselves. You just have to go where you're treated best." End quote. Even here in Idaho, Brad Little was reelected governor with 60% of the vote, despite pretending he never locked down the state, despite avoiding any debates where he might be called out. This is not a good sign for anyone who expects Nuremberg-style tribunals of our leaders and public health officials who destroyed our society in the name of stopping the pandemic. Voters simply have short attention spans, and they don't like it when candidates dwell on the past. I think the best path forward is to pass some laws preventing this from happening ever again. Obviously, we have no power at the federal level, but we can take action in our state and our communities. SJR 102 was a great start. Had the legislature been able to call themselves into session back in April of 2020, they might have been able to curtail some of Governor Little's worst excesses. We need regulation of our district health boards as well. A handful of bureaucrats and a token doctor shouldn't have the authority to force people to stay home or wear masks in public. A huge problem with the pandemic was the way in which it allowed small people to act far too big for their britches. People like Tony Fauci should never again have any authority over a single citizen in our country. Authority in the United States of America is held in trust by our elected leaders on behalf of we the people, and it's not theirs to give away to unelected bureaucrats. Fix that, and we'll be in much better shape the next time a virus crosses the ocean. My name is Brian Allman, and I thank you for watching What's Happening Gem State. I will see you next week.